content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the February 10th, 2025 online edition of the New Yorker. An academic's journey toward reporting. I was used to a disembodied way of working. Identify a philosophical problem, then study it. What could spending time with a philosopher teach me about his ideas? By Joshua Rothman. Early in Ian McEwan's novel, Atonement, from 2001, a young girl sits on the floor, considering how strange it is to have a body. She looks at her hand. Isn't it odd that this machine for gripping this fleshy spider is part of her? She bends a finger and then straightens it. The mystery was in the instant before it moved, the dividing moment between not moving and moving, when her intention took effect, she thinks. It was like a wave breaking. If she could only find herself at the crest, she thought, she might find the secret of herself, that part of her that was really in charge. When I read Atonement in college, I loved this passage. My father was a neuroscientist, and we often talked about the brain. Like the girl in the novel, I was fascinated by the connection between our bodies and our minds. I also admired McEwan's style. There was an openly intellectual, almost technical feeling to his language, which suggested a pleasing convergence of art and science, a tone tailor-made for an English major with a scientist's dad. Atonement isn't really a novel about science. A morality tale, it follows someone who makes a disastrous choice and then tries to make up for it. But McEwan's next novel, Saturday, had a brain surgeon as its protagonist and centered on what philosophers call the mind-body problem, the question of how the physical stuff out of which we are made relates to the subjective experience we have as beings with consciousness. Could it ever be explained how matter becomes conscious? The surgeon asks himself while operating on the brain of a patient. No one knows exactly how this well-protected 1 kilogram or so of cells actually holds experiences, memories, dreams, and intentions, he thinks. Even if that mystery is someday solved, the wonder will remain that mere wet stuff can make this bright inward cinema of thought, of sight and sound and touch, bound into a vivid illusion of an instantaneous present, with a self, another brightly wrought illusion, hovering like a ghost at its center. In the novel, a deranged man breaks into the surgeon's house. Is the man responsible for his actions, or is his brain at fault? If his brain is driving him, presumably our brains drive all our actions, does that somehow make him less of a person? By the time I read Saturday in 2005, I was in graduate school, studying for a PhD in English. For my dissertation, I had decided to look at how novels thought about the mind in the age of neuroscience. Saturday was part of a long tradition. Camillo Golgi devised a technique for seeing the details of neurons in 1873, the same year Leo Tolstoy started writing Anna Karenina. And over the next century, as scientists came to understand more about the brain, novelists grew increasingly determined to portray the workings of mental life. Many novels asked questions that were also posed by philosophers. Did we have free will? How connected were language and thought? Were we just our brains or something more? The philosophical hero of my dissertation, a professor named David Chalmers, was famous for articulating what he called the hard problem. How does the water of the brain turn into the wine of consciousness? Perhaps McEwan's brain surgeon had read him. In Chalmers' mind, science offered no good explanation for how an object could develop a first-person point of view. The dissertation's villain, meanwhile, was Chalmers' nemesis, Daniel Dennett. Dennett, who was also a philosopher, maintained that there was no hard problem. He compared the mind to a computer program running on the hardware of the brain. What's mysterious about that? And in an influential book, Consciousness Explained, characterized people like Chalmers as suffering from philosopher's syndrome, mistaking a failure of the imagination for an insight into necessity. I read Consciousness Explained and a few of Dennett's other books and immersed myself more generally in the field known as philosophy of mind. I was thoroughly unconvinced by his materialist position. He believed that there was no fundamental contradiction between the subjective and the objective points of view. Whether we perceived something as an object or a subject simply depended on the stance we took toward it. I couldn't see how this made sense. In fact, the book made me a little angry. I was with Vladimir Nabokov, who, when asked what surprised him most about life, referred to the marvel of consciousness, that sudden window swinging open on a sunlit landscape amidst the night of non-being. I felt that Dennett and those who thought along similar lines dismissed the uniqueness and sacredness of human existence. My academic advisors, who had indulged me by letting me pursue my project, indulged me further as I added more philosophers and bigger and more forbidding novels into the mix. Years passed. I read and reread, drafted and deleted. Eventually, I realized that I didn't want to be a professor after all, and left my graduate program. I never finished my dissertation, but I profited from the experience of working on it. I read a lot of great books, and I arrived at certain opinions about the big questions that fascinated me. Opinions that I believed were well-founded and unlikely to change. I'd read so much that I figured I knew what I was talking about. In 2017, Dennett published a book called From Bacteria to Bach and Back, The Evolution of Minds. I learned about it in advance from the publisher's publicity department. By then, I was a journalist. My academic life was a decade in the past. In an email to my editors proposing that I write about the book, I noted that I disagreed with Dennett on many fronts and then added, "But what do I know?" At some point, my convictions had cooled. I'd also noticed how good journalism often emerges from the convergence of disagreement and befuddlement. Eventually, my editors and I decided that, instead of reviewing the book, I should write a profile of Dennett, a long piece that described him as a person and recounted the course of his life. Dennett was game, and he and I arranged to meet for the first time in Seattle, where he would be attending a conference. I'd spend a few days with him there, watching him argue about the mind with some philosophers and scientists. Then, later in the month, I'd meet up with him again in Boston. He was a professor at Tufts. Attend his annual black tie Christmas party, punch, piano, caroling, and then drive with him and his wife Susan to Maine, where they'd lived for many years. After staying there for several days, I'd return to New York to interview Chalmers, who now taught at NYU, and then draft my story. I'd written all sorts of pieces, reviews, criticism, essays, but never a profile. I was nervous, both interpersonally and intellectually, about spending so much time with an eminent philosopher whose ideas vexed me. I reread Dennett's books as if I were preparing for an exam. I was taking the scholarly approach. In academia, you proceed methodically, identifying a question and then studying it. You read what's been written and talk it over with colleagues or students. You design experiments or teach seminars or write papers with the aim of becoming an expert and of developing an original view. Failing that, you at least try to explore your question rigorously and systematically. You don't proceed by attending someone's Christmas party and then driving with them to Maine. That approach, reporting, had always struck me as a little odd. Didn't it risk introducing an element of the arbitrary into an otherwise objective process? If you wanted to understand complex questions in philosophy, was hanging out with a single philosopher the right idea? What was the point of knowing what such a person did or wore or ate on the particular days when a reporter visited? Part of me gravitated toward a more disembodied way of working. I wanted to stay in the world of thought. I was still in my grad school era. It was cloudy in Seattle and snowy in Boston and Maine. Danette liked the snow. He walked with a wooden stick he'd carved himself. He had a jolly, indefatigable, relentless energy. He could do seemingly anything. Play piano, call a square dance, glaze a window, whittle, sail. When you talked to him, he stared at you, heavy-lidded, and then disabused you of your misconceptions. But warmly, the way a coach guides a player. I learned a lot about Danette as a person during the time we spent together. I also learned a lot about the value of being there. For one thing, I'd underestimated the importance of time. Reporting meant hours of conversation in the car, room for asking the same questions over and over. The gradual diminishment of one's embarrassment about being ignorant or uncertain. A dilatory attitude of quiet listening and watching. The possibility of misunderstandings resolved. Patient, smart, and imaginative. Danette could explain concepts from every angle, inventing new ones if given the time. And I also hadn't reckoned with the communicativeness of personality, the fullness of an individual, even briefly glimpsed, and what it suggested about what they might know. What is a materialist philosopher, a person who doesn't believe we have souls, supposed to be like? I'd had a picture in my head, something involving coldness, bluntness, harshness, and it was wholly wrong. A caricature waiting to be erased. It wasn't so much that Danette's personality made me reconsider his ideas, but that his specificity made me consider them more specifically. The more you know a person, the more interesting they become. This can be true not just for who they are, but for how they think. And the stakes are higher when you're face to face. It's easy to close a book, and harder to end a conversation. I finished a draft of the profile soon after my return and sent it to my editor. He called me only a few minutes later. Just by scrolling through the document, he said, and registering the blocky regularity of its paragraphs, he could see what the problem was. The piece was like a big essay. There needed to be scenes, sections that read as though they could be in a novel. Exchanges of dialogue, moments of action, tiny little paragraphs suggesting eruptions of physicality. I'd been there in person. What had happened? Readers wanted to be there too. I knew about these sorts of scenes. I had read them in other profiles, but also studied them in novels. In a play, a scene was something formal, a unit of drama, an extended interaction with a clear beginning and end. A scene in a novel could be equally structured, or it could be slippery and elusive, just a beat of concrete reality, or a flash of seeing. A surgeon opening a skull could be a scene, so could a girl waggling her fingers. Scenes could be made simply, of instants beaded together. In Saturday, the surgeon takes a scalpel and makes a small incision. He asks another doctor, "How much blood have we lost?" A different surgeon grasps a special tool, the Adson forceps. He uses the Adson to lift out the congealed blood. This combination of minute narration and distinct, sometimes esoteric or opaque detail, what do Adson forceps look like exactly, can conjure the illusion that we're seeing something real. It can create what the literary theorist Roland Barthes called the reality effect. Gerard Genette, another literary theorist, noticed that novelistic scenes often rely on pseudo-iterative thinking. In a novel, we see something happening just once, in a particular way, and yet the implication is often that it happens that way all the time. When we read Saturday, we learn about a particular brain surgery, but we also see how such surgery tends to unfold. When we read Atonement, we watch a particular girl thinking, but we also recognize how people tend to think about their bodies and minds. And so, a scene is never only a scene. It's a doorway into the rhythms, patterns, and structures of life. At least that's what it is, ideally. Scenes can have the power to mislead us into an inaccurate view of what typically happens. The particulars might be right, but the implication can be wrong. After hearing from my editor, I knew which scenes I wanted to include, which patterns or structures I wanted to illustrate. I needed a scene in which Genette argued with other philosophers. Best of all would be a debate with his nemesis, David Chalmers. Although I'd spoken to Chalmers separately, I had not actually watched him spar with Genette. I had, however, found a recording of one of their confrontations, during which Chalmers accused Genette of not taking consciousness seriously, and Genette responded substantively and almost angrily before smiling and suggesting that it was time to head to the bar. The scene would be important, I thought, not only because it captured Genette in his element, and not only because it included the voice of his primary opponent, but because it showed him being misunderstood, and perhaps misunderstanding someone else. Novels, the critic Mikhail Bakhtin once wrote, are uniquely capable of containing a multiplicity of voices in tension. A reader sees characters tussling over meanings, feelings, ideas, and has the experience of coming to know one's own language as it is perceived in someone else's language, coming to know one's own belief system in someone else's system. Some novels, Bakhtin thought, even allow us to imagine and postulate a unified truth that requires a plurality of consciousnesses, a perspective that is born at a point of contact between people. By knitting together those voices, a profile could similarly allow readers to consider the possibility that all the sides of an argument were, together, right. I wondered, as I wrote those scenes, about what it meant to fuse literary technique with journalistic fact. I combed through my recordings, notes, and photographs to get all the details exactly right. Those details, which would later be verified by fact checkers, were then woven together into something simultaneously non-fictional and dramatic. Braided with essayistic and even scholarly excursions, they created something both exotic and familiar. Was the final product a piece of biography, an intellectual investigation, a record of a real-life encounter between a journalist and a subject? The requirements placed on the story were severe. It had to be a certain length, and have a certain form, and possess the right parts in the right proportion. But it afforded me, as a writer, a special kind of freedom I hadn't previously found. As it happened, Genette persuaded me. By the time I'd finished writing the profile, I no longer believed in the hard problem, and I no longer felt that denying its existence was a slight against my idea of what it meant to be human. The experience left a high water mark in my intellectual life. Ever since, I found it difficult to be satisfied with reading or thinking on my own. If someone's ideas fascinate, perplex, or frustrate me, I want to get to know the person. If I don't understand some question, I want to report it out. I've become painfully aware of how much of what I know, or think I know, could alter in the course of a repertorial process. Recently, when some parents at my son's schools became incensed about developments at the state's education department, I found myself asking whether anyone had actually called up the department and asked what was up. If I finish a novel and can't stop thinking about it, my mind turns inevitably to the idea of the novelist as an individual. Who is she? Up close. And how does she really live and think? There are limits to this way of approaching the world. Not all questions benefit from being explored narratively. Sometimes we want statistical coolness, dispassionate objectivity, scientific clarity. In an era of endlessly revised alternative facts, there's immense value in the simple and consistent articulation of what's been rigorously shown to be true. Meanwhile, artificial intelligence can seemingly write about anything, synthesizing what's already known, bending it into desirable and useful configurations, producing lengthy reports on any subject on demand without obvious human fingerprints. The strangeness of literary journalism, with its recording of an idiosyncratic collision between a writer and a subject, its melding of the subjective and the objective, stands in ever greater relief. Dinette died last year at the age of 82. When I heard that news, I spent a while leafing through his books, revisiting the highlighted passages that had struck me most. The tangible, entirely non-mystical complexity of the natural world, he wrote, was staggering and awe-inspiring, greater than anything any of us will ever conceive of in detail worthy of its detail. I also reread the profile. In her book, The Situation and the Story, Vivian Gornick suggests that all literary writing has both a concrete and an emotional aspect. Elizabeth Bishop's poem, In the Waiting Room, for example, is concretely about a young girl sitting in a dentist's office, perusing an issue of National Geographic, and overhearing her aunt, who is in the dentist chair, cry out in pain. It's emotionally about that same girl's first experience of isolation, her own, her aunt's, and that of the world. The concrete part is the situation. The emotional part is the story. It's easy, Gornick thinks, to describe a situation and much harder to recognize a story, even when it's yours. What story had I told? I'd shown Dinette, I believed, as a person determined to convince others of views that he thought were right, but that they found inconceivable. Tirelessly, generously, tenaciously, brooking no resistance, he pushed and pushed against their intuitions, knowing that they might well return to their original incorrect shapes once his pushing ceased. His story was about faith in other people and the toughness it required. And my story, since I was in the profile too, was about being pushed and resisting it, and then being grateful for it. A reporter is often pictured as an active person, rushing around, finding things out. And this is not wrong. But at the same time, the reporter is not totally in charge. He's involved, available, subject to his subject. As readers, we get to watch as the writer's wave breaks against the shore he finds. And now, the profile mentioned in the previous story, from the March 27th, 2017 issue of The New Yorker, Daniel Dennett's Science of the Soul, A Philosopher's Lifelong Quest to Understand the Making of the Mind, by Joshua Rothman. 4 billion years ago, Earth was a lifeless place. Nothing struggled, thought, or wanted. Slowly, that changed. Seawater leached chemicals from rocks. Near thermal vents, those chemicals jostled and combined. Some hit upon the trick of making copies of themselves that, in turn, made more copies. The replicating chains were caught in oily bubbles, which protected them and made replication easier. Eventually, they began to venture out into the open sea. A new level of order had been achieved on Earth. Life had begun. The tree of life grew, its branches stretching toward complexity. Organisms developed systems, subsystems, and sub-subsystems, layered in ever-deepening regression. They used these systems to anticipate their future and to change it. When they looked within, some found that they had selves, constellations of memories, ideas, and purposes that emerged from the systems inside. They experienced being alive and had thoughts about that experience. They developed language and used it to know themselves. They began to ask how they had been made. This, to a first approximation, is the secular story of our creation. It has no single author. It's been written collaboratively by scientists over the past few centuries. If, however, it could be said to belong to any single person, that person might be Daniel Dennett, a 74-year-old philosopher who teaches at Tufts. In the course of 40 years and more than a dozen books, Dennett has endeavored to explain how a soulless world could have given rise to a soulful one. His special focus is the creation of the human mind. Into his own, he has crammed nearly every related discipline: evolutionary biology, neuroscience, psychology, linguistics, artificial intelligence. His newest book, From Bacteria to Bach and Back, tells us there is a winding path leading through a jungle of science and philosophy, from the initial bland assumption that we people are physical objects obeying the laws of physics, to an understanding of our conscious minds. Dennett has walked that path before. In Consciousness Explained, a 1991 bestseller, he described consciousness as something like the product of multiple layered computer programs running on the hardware of the brain. Many readers felt that he had shown how the brain creates the soul. Others thought that he'd missed the point entirely. To them, the book was like a treatise on music that focused exclusively on the physics of musical instruments. It left untouched the question of how a 3-pound lump of neurons could come to possess a point of view, interiority, selfhood, consciousness, qualities that the rest of the material world lacks. These skeptics derided the book as Consciousness Explained Away. Nowadays, philosophers are divided into two camps. The physicalists believe, with Dennett, that science can explain consciousness in purely material terms. The dualists believe that science can uncover only half the picture. It can't explain what Nabokov called the marvel of consciousness, that sudden window swinging open on a sunlit landscape amidst the night of non-being. Late last year, Dennett found himself among such skeptics at the Edgewater Hotel in Seattle, where the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research had convened a meeting about animal consciousness. The Edgewater was once a rock and roll hangout. In the late 60s and 70s, members of Led Zeppelin were notorious for their escapades there. But it's now plush and sedate, with overstuffed armchairs and roaring fireplaces. In a fourth-floor meeting room with views of Mount Rainier, dozens of researchers shared speculative work on honeybee brains, mouse minds, octopus intelligence, avian cognition, and the mental faculties of monkeys and human children. At the sunset, on the last day of the conference, the experts found themselves circling a familiar puzzle known as the zombie problem. Suppose that you're a scientist studying octopuses. How would you know whether an octopus is conscious? It interacts with you, responds to its environment, and evidently pursues goals. But a non-conscious robot could also do those things. The problem is that there's no way to observe consciousness directly. From the outside, it's possible to imagine that the octopus is a zombie, physically alive but mentally empty. And, in theory, the same could be true of any apparently conscious being. The zombie problem is a conversational vortex among those who study animal minds. The researchers, anticipating the discussion's inexorable transformation into a meditation on Westworld, clutched their heads and sighed. Dennett sat at the seminar table like a king on his throne, broad-shouldered and imposing, with a fluffy white beard and a round belly. He resembles a cross between Darwin and Santa Claus. He has meaty hands and a sonorous voice. Many young philosophers of mine look like artists, skinny jeans, t-shirts, asymmetrical hair. But Danette carries a homemade walking stick and dresses like a Maine fisherman in beat-up boat shoes and a pocketed vest, a costume that gives him an air of unpretentious competence. He regards the zombie problem as a typically philosophical waste of time. The problem presupposes that consciousness is like a light switch. Either an animal has a self or it doesn't. But Danette thinks these things are like evolution, essentially gradualist, without hard borders. The obvious answer to the question of whether animals have selves is that they sort of have them. He loves the phrase, sort of. Picture the brain, he often says, as a collection of subsystems that sort of know, think, decide, and feel. These layers build up incrementally to the real thing. Animals have fewer mental layers than people. In particular, they lack language, which Danette believes endows human mental life with its complexity and texture. But this doesn't make them zombies. It just means that they sort of have consciousness, as measured by human standards. Danette waited until the group talked itself into a muddle, then broke in. He speaks slowly, melodiously, in the confident tones of a man with answers. When he uses philosophical lingo, his voice goes deeper, as if he were distancing himself from it. "The big mistake we're making," he said, "is taking our congenial shared understanding of what it's like to be us, which we learn from novels and plays and talking to each other, and then applying it back down the animal kingdom. Wittgenstein," he deepened his voice, "famously wrote, 'If a lion could talk, we couldn't understand him.' But no, if a lion could talk, we'd understand him just fine. He just wouldn't help us understand anything about lions."
"Because he wouldn't be a lion," another researcher said.
"Right," Danette replied. "He would be so different from regular lions that he wouldn't tell us what it's like to be a lion. I think we should just get used to the fact that the human concepts we apply so comfortably in our everyday lives apply only sort of to animals," he concluded. "The notorious zombie problem is just a philosopher's fantasy. It's not anything that we have to take seriously."
"Dan, I honestly get stuck on this," a primate psychologist said. "If you say, well, rocks don't have consciousness, I want to agree with you." But he found it difficult to get an imaginative grip on the idea of a monkey with a sort of mind.
"If philosophy were a sport, its ball would be human intuition. Philosophers compete to shift our intuitions from one end of the field to the other. Some intuitions, however, resist being shifted. Among these is our conviction that there are only two states of being, awake or asleep, conscious or unconscious, alive or dead, soulful or material. Danette believes that there is a spectrum and that we can train ourselves to find the idea of that spectrum intuitive."
"If you think there's a fixed meaning of the word consciousness and we're searching for that, then you're already making a mistake," Danette said.
"I hear you're as skeptical about whether consciousness is useful as a scientific concept," another researcher ventured.
"Yes, yes," Danette said.
That's the question," the researcher replied, "because if the answer's no, then we should really go home."
"No, no," Danette exclaimed, as the room erupted into laughter. He'd done it again. In attempting to explain consciousness, he'd explained it away. In the 19th century, scientists and philosophers couldn't figure out how non-living things became living. They thought that living things possessed a mysterious life force. Only over time did they discover that life was the product of diverse physical systems that, together, created something that appeared magical. Danette believes that the same story will be told about consciousness. He wants to tell it, but he sometimes wonders if others want to hear it. The person who tells people how an effect is achieved is often resented, considered a spoilsport, a party pooper, he wrote around a decade ago in a paper called Explaining the Magic of Consciousness. If you actually manage to explain consciousness, they say, you will diminish us all, turn us into mere protein robots, mere things. Dinette does not believe that we are mere things. He thinks that we have souls, but he is certain that those souls can be explained by science. If evolution built them, they can be reverse engineered. There ain't no magic here, he told me, just stage magic. During the course of his career, Dinette has developed a way of looking at the process by which raw matter becomes functional. Some objects are mere assemblages of atoms to us and have only a physical dimension. When we think of them, he says, we adopt a physicalist stance. The stance we inhabit when, using equations, we predict the direction of a tropical storm. When it comes to more sophisticated objects, which have purposes and functions, we typically adopt a design stance. We say that a leaf's purpose is to capture energy from sunlight and that a nut and bolt are designed to fit together. Finally, there are objects that seem to have beliefs and desires toward which we take the intentional stance. If you're playing chess with a chess computer, you don't scrutinize the conductive properties of its circuits or contemplate the inner workings of its operating system, the physicalist and design stances, respectively. You ask how the program is thinking, what it's planning, and what it wants to do. These different stances capture different levels of reality, and our language reveals which one we've adopted. We say that proteins fold, the physicalist stance, but that eyes see, the design stance. We say that the chess computer anticipated our move, that the driverless car decided to swerve when the deer leaped into the road. A running joke among people who study consciousness is that Dinette himself might be a zombie. Only a zombie like Dinette could write a book called Consciousness Explained that doesn't address consciousness at all, the computer scientist Jaron Lanier has written. The implicit criticism is that Dinette's account of consciousness treats the self like a computer and reflects a disengagement from things like feeling and beauty. Dinette seems wounded by this idea. There are those wags who insist that I was born with an impoverished mental life, he told me. That ain't me. I seem to be drinking in life's joys pretty well. Dinette studied philosophy as an undergraduate with W.V.O. Quinn, the Harvard logician. His scientific awakening came later when he was a graduate student at Oxford. With a few classmates, he found himself debating what happens when your arm falls asleep. The others were discussing the problem in abstract philosophical terms, sensation, perception, and the like, which struck Dinette as odd. 2 decades earlier, the philosopher Gilbert Ryle, Dinette's dissertation advisor, had coined the phrase the ghost in the machine to mock the theory associated with René Descartes that our physical bodies are controlled by immaterial souls. The other students were talking about the ghost. Dinette wanted to study the machine. He began teaching himself neuroscience the next day. Later, with the help of various academic friends and neighbors, Dinette learned about psychology, computer programming, linguistics, and artificial intelligence, the disciplines that came to form cognitive science. One of Dinette's early collaborators was Douglas Hofstadter, the polymath genius whose book about the mind, Gödel, Escher, Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid, became an unlikely bestseller in 1979. When he was young, he played the philosophy game very strictly, Hofstadter said of Dinette. He studied the analytical philosophers and the continental philosophers and wrote pieces that responded to them in the traditional way. But then he started deviating from the standard pathway. He became much more informed by science than many of his colleagues. And he grew very frustrated with the constant prevalent belief among them in such things as zombies. These things started to annoy him, and he started writing piece after piece to try to destroy the myths that he considered these to be, the religious residues of dualism. Arguments, Dinette found, rarely shift intuitions. It's through stories that we revise our sense of what's natural. He called such stories intuition pumps. In 1978, he published a short story called Where Am I?, in which a philosopher, also named Daniel Dennett, is asked to volunteer for a dangerous mission to disarm an experimental nuclear warhead. The warhead, which is buried beneath Tulsa, Oklahoma, emits a kind of radiation that's safe for the body, but lethal to the brain. Government scientists decide on a radical plan. They separate Dennett's brain from his body, using radio transmitters implanted in his skull, to allow the brain, which is stored in a vat in Houston, to control the body as it approaches the warhead. Think of it as a mere stretching of the nerves, the scientists say. If your brain were just moved over an inch in your skull, that would not alter or impair your mind. We're simply going to make the nerves indefinitely elastic by splicing radio links into them. After the surgery, Dennett is led into the brain support lab. I peered through the glass. There, floating in what looked like ginger ale, was undeniably a human brain, though it was almost covered with printed circuit chips, plastic tubules, electrodes, and other paraphernalia. I thought to myself, well, here I am sitting on a folding chair, staring through a piece of plate glass at my own brain. But wait, I said to myself, shouldn't I have thought? Here I am, suspended in a bubbly fluid, being stared at by my own eyes. I tried and tried to think myself into the vat, but to no avail. Toward the end of the story, the radio equipment malfunctions and Dennett's point of view is instantly relocated. It is an impressive demonstration of the immateriality of the soul based on physicalist principles and premises, he writes. For as the last radio signal between Tulsa and Houston died away, had I not changed location from Tulsa to Houston at the speed of light? The story contains only neurons and machines and is entirely materialist. Even so, it shows that you aren't situated in your brain the same way you're situated in a room. It also suggests that the intuitions upon which philosophers so confidently rely are actually illusions created by an elaborate system of machinery. Only rarely do cracks in the illusion of consciousness appear through which one might see the machinery at work. Proust inspected the state between sleep and wakefulness. Coleridge experimented with mind-altering drugs. Neuroscientists examine minds compromised by brain injury. Dennett's approach has been to look back into evolutionary history. In the minds of other animals, even insects, Dennett believes we can see the functional components upon which our selfhood depends. We can also see the qualities we value most in human selfhood in sort of form. Even free will, he thinks, evolves over evolutionary time. Your amygdala, the part of the brain that registers fear, may not be free in any meaningful sense. It's effectively a robot. But it endows the mind to which it belongs with the ability to avoid danger. In this way, the winding path leads from determinism to freedom to a whole can be freer than its parts. Along with Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and the late Christopher Hitchens, Dennett is often cited as one of the four horsemen of the new atheism. In a 2000 book called Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, he argued that religion ought to be studied rather than practiced. Recently, with the researcher Linda LaScola, he published Caught in the Pulpit, Leaving Belief Behind, a book of interviews with clergy people who have lost their faith. He can be haughty in his dismissal of religion. A few years ago, while he was recovering from his aortic dissection, he wrote an essay called Thank Goodness, in which he chastised well-wishers for saying, thank God. He urged them instead to thank goodness, as embodied by the doctors, nurses, and scientists who were genuinely responsible for the fact that I am alive. Yet, Dennett is also comfortable with religion. even in some ways nostalgic for it. Like his wife, he was brought up as a Congregationalist, and although he never believed in God, he enjoyed going to church. For much of his life, Danette has sung sacred music in choirs. He gets misty-eyed when he recalls singing Bach's St. Matthew Passion. He and Susan tried sending their children to Sunday school so that they could enjoy the music, sermons, and Bible stories. But it didn't take. Danette's sister, Cynthia, is a minister, a saintly person, Danette says admiringly, who's a little annoyed by her little brother. The materialist worldview is often associated with despair. In Anna Karenina, Konstantin Levin, the novel's hero, stares into the night sky, reflects upon his brief bubble-like existence in an infinite and indifferent universe, and contemplates suicide. For Danette, however, materialism is spiritually satisfying. In a 1995 book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea, he asks, how long did it take Johann Sebastian Bach to create the St. Matthew Passion? Bach, he notes, had to live for 42 years before he could begin writing it, and he drew on 2,000 years of Christianity, indeed, on all of human culture. The subsystems of his mind had been evolving for even longer, creating Homo sapiens, Danette writes, required billions of years of irreplaceable design work, performed not by God, of course, but by natural selection. Darwin's dangerous idea, Danette writes, is that Bach's music, Christianity, human culture, the human mind, and Homo sapiens all exist as fruits of a single tree, the tree of life, which created itself, not in a miraculous instantaneous whoosh, but slowly, slowly. Danette asks, is this tree of life a god one could worship, pray to, fear? Probably not. But, he says, it is greater than anything any of us will ever conceive of in detail worthy of its detail. I could not pray to it, but I can stand in affirmation of its magnificence. This world is sacred. Dennett has a philosophical arch nemesis, an Australian named David Chalmers. Chalmers, who teaches at NYU and at the Australian National University, believes that Danette only sort of understands consciousness. In his view, Danette's theories don't adequately explain subjective experience or why there is an inner life in the first place. Chalmers and Danette are as different as two philosophers of mind can be. Chalmers wears a black leather jacket over a black t-shirt. He believes in the zombie problem and is the lead singer of a consciousness-themed rock band that performs a song called The Zombie Blues. I act like you act. I do what you do. What consciousness is, I ain't got a clue. I got the zombie blues. In his most important book, The Conscious Mind, published in 1996, Chalmers accused Danette and the physicalists of focusing on the easy problems of consciousness. Questions about the workings of neurons or other cognitive systems, while ignoring the hard problem. A formulation he likes is, how does the water of the brain turn into the wine of consciousness? Since then, the hard problem has been a rallying cry for those philosophers who think that Danette's view of the mind is incomplete. Consider your laptop. It's processing information, but isn't having experiences. Now, suppose that every year your laptop gets smarter. A few years from now, it may, like IBM's Watson, win Jeopardy. Soon afterward, it may have meaningful conversations with you, like the smartphone voiced by Scarlett Johansson in Her. Johansson's character is conscious. You can fall in love with her, and she with you. There's a soul in that phone. But how did it get there? How was the inner space of consciousness opened up within the circuits and code? This is the hard problem. Danette regards it, too, as a philosopher's fantasy. Chalmers thinks that, at the present,
it is insurmountable. If it's easy for you to imagine a conscious robot, then you probably side with Dinette. If it's easier to imagine a robot that only seems conscious, you're probably with Chalmers. For many years, I took Chalmers' side in this dispute. I read Dinette's Consciousness Explained, but I felt that something crucial was missing. I couldn't understand how neurons, even billions of neurons, could generate the experience of being me. Terence Deacon, an anthropologist who writes about consciousness and neuroscience, refers to, quote, the Cartesian wound that separated mind from body at the birth of modern science, end quote. For a long time, not even the profoundly informed arguments that Dinette advanced proved capable of healing that wound. Then, late last year, my mother had a catastrophic stroke. It devastated the left side of her brain, wrecking her parietal and temporal lobes and Broca's area, parts of the brain that are involved in the emotions, the senses, memory, and speech. My mother now appears to be living in an eternal present. She can only say two words, water and time. She is present in the room. She looks me in the eye, but is capable of only fleeting recognition. She knows only that I am someone she should recognize. She grasps the world, but lightly. As I spent time with my mother, I found that my intuitions were shifting to Dinette's side of the field. It seems natural to say that she sort of thinks, knows, cares, remembers, and understands, and that she is sort of conscious. It seems obvious that there is no light switch for consciousness. She is present and absent in different ways, depending on which of her subsystems are functioning. I still can't quite picture how neurons create consciousness, but perhaps because I can take a stance toward my mother that I can't take toward myself, my belief in the hard problem has dissolved. On an almost visceral level, I find it easier to accept the reality of the material mind. I have moved from agnosticism to calm conviction. On a morning this past winter, Dinette sat in an armchair in his main living room. The sky and water were blue and bright. He'd acquired two copies of the Ellsworth American, the local newspaper. Later, he and Susan would sit by the fireplace and compete to see who could finish the crossword first. In the meantime, he was thinking about the nature of understanding. He recalled a time, many years ago, when he found himself lecturing a group of physicists. He showed them a slide that read E equals MC squared and asked if anyone in the audience understood it. Almost all of the physicists raised their hands, but one man sitting in the front protested. "Most of the people in this room are experimentalists," he said. "They think they understand this equation, but really they don't. The only people who really understand it are the theoreticians." Understanding, too, comes in degrees, Dinette concluded, back in his main living room. So how do you take that last step? What if the answer is, well, you can only sort of take it? Physics, Dinette said, tells us that there are more than three dimensions, and we can use math to prove they're there. At the same time, we struggle to picture them in our heads. That does not mean that they're not real. Perhaps, he thought, the wholly material soul is similarly hard to imagine. I'm not ready to say it's unimaginable, because there are times when I think I can imagine it, he said. And then it doesn't seem to be such a big leap at all. But it is. Before the morning slipped away, Dinette decided to go out for a walk, down to where the lawn ended and a rocky beach began. He had long delighted in a particular rock formation, where a few stones were piled just so, creating a peephole. He was disappointed to find that the tides had rearranged the stones and that the hole had disappeared. The dock was pulled ashore for the winter, its parts stacked next to his sailboat. He walked down the steps anyway, occasionally leaning on his walking stick. For a few minutes, he stood at the bottom, savoring the frigid air, the lapping water, the dazzling sun. In the New Yorker Centennial issue, published this month, is something extraordinary, a previously unknown Robert Frost poem. The poem was found in a recently deceased retired educator's home library by a family friend, a book dealer, Ed Smith, near Puget Sound in Washington State. Robert Frost had handwritten and signed the poem on the front free-in paper of Frost's book, North of Boston, published in 1918. The New Yorker's Jay Perini describes it as, quote, a good poem, short and aphoristic, from a period when Frost, writing at the height of his powers, had a special affection for poems of this kind, brief, rueful, tight, focused. And, with no further ado, Nothing New by Robert Frost, written in 1918 in Amherst, published for the first time in February 2025 in The New Yorker. One moment when the dust today against my face was turned to spray, I dreamed the winter dreams again. I dreamed when I was young at play, yet strangely not more sad than then. Nothing new. Though I am further upon my way, the same dream again. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. That number again, 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.